Sam Rockwell, and you're listening to Get Your Film Fix Podcast.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin.
God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
All right, hello and welcome to this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I'm Brantley Palmer, and I'm joined by Jeremy Fisk and Lee Carlo. The original Three Musketeers are back, gentlemen.
Can anybody explain to me why the new Three Musketeers movie has four musketeers?
Well, I thought that's like the premise of like all the Three Musketeers, that there's like that fourth member that like begins to join or whatever, and then they have
I don't know.
He's the nougat filling.
Orlando Bloom is in it. Who cares?
That's true. But then again, Ray Stevenson's in it, and I kind of care about Ray Stevenson.
It looks horrible.
It does. I'm not confident. It doesn't look good.
No.
Anyway, I don't know why we're talking about the Three Musketeers. Obviously, I brought it up, so I shouldn't have.
I don't know why we're talking about what I brought up. This is why we don't do the podcast anymore.
This is why you don't wing the opening, Bradley.
Well, this is also why, Jeremy, this is why we're not supposed to talk during his opening. It throws them all off.
I know. Now I'm all over the place. I don't even know what we're talking about. No. On this edition of the podcast, we are going to be taking a look at the new Bennett Miller film, Moneyball, which, coincidentally, we all worked on. And I think that'll be the only time we review a movie that we all worked on this site. Also, what was that? Did you just talk during my open? You son of a bitch.
I don't even know what he said. He was very nervous and timid about it.
I know. Anyway. Did we review that on our site?
Did we review our own movie?
We should.
See, we could, but I don't think we actually would review our own movie.
It's like this movie was garbage.
Yeah, I think we don't review it because we're afraid of what we're going to say.
We're too honest.
And then we're going to have a mini-review of Nicholas Winding Refn's Drive. And then we're going to wrap everything all up with our top five sports scenes. Not sports movies. Sports scenes. They could be sports scenes that aren't even in sports movies.
You say it like we did it wrong.
No.
I say it
with much specificity because I want to be
wrong. We haven't done it yet. This is the beginning.
We haven't done it yet. Seriously, Jeremy.
Oh, right.
Are you in a space-time continuum right now where like you went to the top fives already and then just came back and were like, hey, I know how we did it
wrong. If I had a space-time continuum, I wouldn't go to the top fives.
Hey, I don't know.
How can I best utilize this technology?
Let me see what they're doing for their top five. This is ridiculous. This is the most ridiculous intro ever. I love it.
It's ridiculously long. It's. I feel like there's been a lot of talking during it, which means.
Thanks for summing it up.
Yeah, a lot of talking. It's been going on for a while.
A lot of talking in the intro. Kind of like there's a lot of words in that book you read.
I'm extending it more right now by continuing to talk about this intro.
This intro is so long, it needs a summary, apparently.
Yes, apparently.
There are rich teams, and there are poor teams. Then there's 50 feet of crap. And then there's us.
That's a dollar, man. What? Welcome to Oakland.
I need more money.
We're not New York. Fine players are the money that we do have.
I like Perez.
Got an ugly girlfriend. Ugly girlfriend means no confidence.
You guys are talking the same old nonsense like we're looking for Fabio. We got to think differently.
Who's Fabio?
Your goal shouldn't be to buy players. Your goal should be to buy wins. And in order to buy wins, you need to buy runs.
Who are you?
I'm Peter Brand.
First job in baseball?
It's my first job anywhere.
We're going to shake things up. Why don't you walk me through the board?
I believe there's a championship team that we could afford because everyone else undervalues them, like an island of misfit toys.
We want you at first base. I've only ever played catcher.
It's not that hard, Scott. Tell him, Wash.
It's incredibly hard.
He can't throw.
But what can he do?
You want me to speak?
We're not pointing you yet.
He gets on base.
We are card counters at the blackjack table.
We're going to turn the odds on the casino.
I'm heading in. Text me the play-by-play.
Wait, what?
I don't watch the games.
So this week is sort of a special week here on Get Your Film Fix because we have the three original members back on the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I think for the first time in a month.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
Fright Night was the last one I had notes for, so whenever that was, we were all on that one.
Yep.
And it's also sort of a special podcast, and I think this is a good one that we're all back here on. It's because we are reviewing Moneyball, a movie and probably the only movie that we will be reviewing that all three of us worked on. And my question to you guys is, even the small amount of contribution that we had to this movie, are you proud to have worked on this film?
I'll say I was. I mean, this is really kind of the only, like, really big budget movie I'd worked on. And granted, it was just for, like, when they were in Boston, which was only for a couple days, and I only worked on it for one. But it was good at least to get, you know, experience being on, like, a big film, which I thought was pretty cool. I mean, I'm kind of proud to be on it.
I mean, as far as, like, if you mean in the sense that, like, am I glad my name is attached to, you know, this movie? Like, it wasn't garbage, so in that sense, it was great. I thought it was a really good movie, so it's kind of cool to think that, you know, people are going to be talking about Moneyball, I think, for the next several months, and, you know, I'll be like, yeah, I spent some time on that set. So, yeah, I mean, that's definitely something to be proud of, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think it was phenomenal, and I am certainly proud to have been on it even for a couple days, and I've worked on several movies, and every time it seems like right in the middle of working on them, I'm always like, what is the point? Why are we spending so much money on and so many hours and so much manpower on something that in the end somebody's probably just going to go, eh, that was all right, and that was it. And watching Moneyball is the first time in a long time I was watching a movie and I was just absorbed by the film, and I was taken away by a movie, and I wasn't thinking of what are my talking points going to be on the podcast. Why is this working? Why isn't this working? I was actually just watching a movie, and I was totally engrossed in the film as a film, and it sort of restored my faith in movies, especially this year. That's how much I love this film.
Yeah, I mean, it was a combination. Like, yesterday, for me, was a good day at the movies, because I went in, I saw the trailer for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, I saw the trailer for J. Edgar, and then I saw Moneyball, and I'm like, okay, I have been bashing this year like nobody else, and rightfully so. This has been a bad year for movies, but, you know, it's this time of year when good movies come out, and Moneyball kind of kicked it off for me. And, you know, we'll talk a little bit about Drive, and I, you know, to spoil a little bit, I thought Drive was good, but it didn't have the kind of you know, impact that Moneyball did as far as, like, a big-time movie that really, like, kicked off the Oscar season, and that got me really excited about the next couple months.
Well, let's talk about why. Why were we so engrossed in Moneyball? Why, you know, this is a film about statistics. This is a film about numbers. If there's one thing we don't like here at Get Your Film Fix, it's numbers and math and statistics. And yet this movie was so engrossing on a human level. How were they able to pull that off?
Because it's not really about statistics. It's about a human struggle, like you said. This story is about Brad Pitt and his obstacle to overcome, like, immense odds, and that those being, like, changing something that's 100 years old. And it's more about that and his relationships, specifically with Jonah Hill, his relationships with his team,
his daughter.
And to a lesser degree with his daughter. Yeah. I mean, it's a human story. It's a character study. It's not really about math and statistics. That's just what he's doing.
Although the math and the statistics and the baseball are what, like, sort of pulls you in at the beginning, especially if you're a fan. And I think it would work even if you weren't a fan of baseball, but especially if you're a fan of baseball and sports and how you can sort of beat a game mathematically. That's interesting, right? I mean, that's probably what gets you pulled in, you know, right from the get-go, and then once you're in, you're really rooting for these people as people, which is ironic because this movie or Billy Beane was all about putting up wins, putting up the statistics that are going to lead to wins. But ultimately, this movie was about people, and that's why it worked.
I mean, it's. I wonder if, and you mentioned that this movie would be good for somebody who, you know, isn't a fan or anything, and I wonder if maybe even they'd be a bigger fan of this movie because, you know, we know the story, even if we don't know the little details and whatnot. We know the story. We know what Billy Beane created has worked, obviously, because it kind of worked first for the Red Sox, if you want to see the whole thing all the way through. But, you know, if you don't know that, if you don't really know what's going to happen, then you're adding that element of surprise to a movie, you know, that we didn't really get, I think, or at least I didn't really get, which is interesting because, like, I think that this is a smart enough screenplay, the storytelling is basic, and Brad Pitt is great in this movie, so it never mattered for me. Like, I was engrossed regardless, but I wonder, you know, the perspective of someone who knows nothing about this, who's never read the book, who doesn't follow sports, and just goes into this, you know, clean.
Oh, go ahead, Bradley.
Oh, yeah, no, I was just going to say, I mean, I feel like anyone who knows baseball or is a fan of sabermetrics or knows or has read the book before is going to get just as much out of it as someone who hasn't. And I think I can say that with experience. Cause I went to a free screening of this in the Boston area, and just the responses from the people around me, you could just tell that, like, they knew – they had no idea about the story or baseball in general, and yet they were totally into the movie. There's, like, a group of, like, older women to my right who, like, were – well, first off, they were commenting all the time, which was annoying, but they were also, like – you could tell they just didn't know much about baseball because they're like dip, you know, they're chewing dip and everything and spitting it out, and they're constantly going, oh,
the ladies next to you were gross.
No, they're all coming like, oh, it's so disgusting. Oh, it's just, oh, he's spitting it out the dip, and he, oh, he's pulling it out of his mouth. Oh, that's so
wow,
gross.
That would have killed me if I was.
I know.
I would have been like, all right, enough.
It was annoying, but you could tell they were still really into the movie and still got a kick out of it, even though it is a movie about like statistics. And I think the movie even does a good job of that by constantly showing these close-up shots of, like, numbers and money, whether it's payroll of the Yankees or stats or whatever. But it also still has a human element that's going to draw any person in because it's a compelling story.
What's so interesting about this film is how well they were able to toe that line. It never sort of babied you through. Like, people like you were saying, who don't know anything about it could follow it, but for the people who had read Moneyball or knew all this stuff, it never babied you through it either. It was able to toe that line really well. And I think the reason they were able to do that is because the screenplay and Bennett Miller concentrated on this movie as a character piece. And they were able to dish out the information they needed to dish out when they needed to without ever, you know, babying their audience, and I think they did such a good job of that, and that's why I never was taken out of this movie, even for a second. I was never taken out to say, oh, why did this work? Why didn't this work? How's Brad Pitt's acting? Why is Jonah Hill in this movie? You know, I never said any of that. It all just flowed. It all, you know, I was just super engaged.
Sorry, I was just going to say, just going right off that, there were times when I was, like, pulled out because it was Jonah Hill. And that's only because the movie, the development of it, has such a history where, you know, Soderbergh was originally attached to direct, and he had Dimitri Martin set and ready to go to play Paul DePodesta, which is the actual name of the character, of the character in the book in real life. I believe he's now the GM of, like, the San Diego Padres, or is it within the Padres organization? And then, of course, he famously took his name off the movie kind of when the director switched, and then, like, Jonah Hill is set up to, like, play him in the movie. And I think anyone who knows the original story of Moneyball knows Paul DePodesta is fairly tall. I think he's over 6 feet, and he's really skinny. So the fact that very short, very heavier set Jonah Hill is like playing the fictionalized version of Paul DePodesta in Peter Brand. That kind of took me out every once in a while, but I don't think it was enough to really like you know, cause any kind of major issues with me at all. Which is, and it's funny too, because Dimitri Martin was set to play him when Soderbergh was attached to Wreck, and then Soderbergh gives Dimitri Martin a small role in Contagion, which ends up being like his next movie. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, if anything took me out of the movie at times, it was Jonah Hill. I don't think he was bad, but there were times where I felt like he was a little out of his league, you know, pun intended. But you know, none of what you just said, none of that was the reason. I didn't know that story. I remember you talking about it, but I don't know. I don't know if he has the dramatic chops to be in a movie like this, but he held his own for the most part.
See, I mean. Sorry, I was gonna say for me, like it wasn't anything about his performance or anything he had done that took me out of it. It was simply the fact that he was the one playing that character when I knew in real life that character was so different.
Right.
I think his performance was great. I think he was fine. And beginning of this year, you guys were excited, and I was very excited about a Brad Pitt movie called Tree of Life, and I thought Pitt was just fine in that. I mean, I don't think he was great, but I think this is by far the better performance. It is such an understated performance. He never tries to showboat it, even though this movie is solely about him. He just sort of cruises through this movie on one level that just really works. And, you know, I think this is one of Brad Pitt's best performances.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. There's nothing flashy about it. But he's great, and I mean, if you pay close attention to his character, it has some cliches to it, which he manages to avoid. For example, like, I mean, the way they create Billy Bean, like, you know, he doesn't really have any flaws if you kind of look at his character in this movie. Like, he's, you know, he's never, I mean, you see him flip out a couple times because he's mad about the way things are going, but, like, he never crumbles under pressure. Like, he's smooth, he's good looking, like, I mean, you know,
he's good with
his
family.
Yeah, even though he's divorced, like, everything is great about Billy Bean. But Pitt kind of makes you forget about that. Like, the sentimental scenes with his daughter don't seem cheesy or, like, one-dimensional. I mean, I don't know, you know, what he did to make that work, but, you know, I thought he was amazing in this movie. And if he doesn't get any credit, it's because it's not a flashy performance. It's not it doesn't call attention to itself.
And that's sort of disappointing because those are harder performances sometimes to pull off than the flashy ones.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say that, you know, I remember there was some review that, like, mentioned that, you know, he played the character like Robert Redford would have in the 70s, you know, and that it was kind of, I mean, not star-making, obviously, because Brad Pitt's a star, but it was really kind of like a performance that very much stood out a la, you know, a more classic actor like, you know, Robert Redford before him. But also to the character of Billy Bean, though, I mean, I think that he definitely has flaws. I mean, you mentioned, like, the anger and rage and everything. But, I mean, the fact that like, his character doesn't have the best personal skills, I think, is a big one as well. I mean, you obviously see the way he handles certain, like, people and certain characters, like the scouts and things like that. He's not a very personable person. And I think that's also one of the flaws, though, with his character. You know, it's
at it as, like, none of it is to the detriment of him as far as the audience sees it. Like, all of that is, like, and no matter how he talks to the scouts or anytime he's, like, uncomfortable with someone, we are always on Billy Bean's side in this movie. And it's because he's the protagonist, so that's fine. And, like I said, none of this hurt the movie. But, like, you know, it was never like, well, he's got to listen more to these scouts. Like, he's just being stubborn. Like, those aspects of his character were not to the detriment of his character, if that makes sense.
No, I mean, I see what you're saying, but, I mean, I still think it is a character flaw that he's not really listening to too many other people. I mean, basically, he heard what Peter Brand, his thoughts were on a baseball team, and he was like, okay, I'm going to definitely do this. Like, my mind's completely made up. And so anyone who voices any opposite type of opinion, he's not even going to listen to. You know what I mean? So, I mean, I think that's still a flaw for him.
Well, I want to talk about Bennett Miller, briefly at least, because he's a director who, you know, I haven't really been behind because I thought he undeservedly got a Best Director nomination for Capote. I remember thinking, and it's one of the few things I remember about Capote, is that the movie wasn't well directed. And then, you know, being on set, we were, like, scrambling all over the place, deciding what shots we were going to, not we personally, but we as a crew, deciding what shots we were going to do. They're making up stuff as they go. And, you know, I remember we were discussing that and, like, how can you do that on a $200 million movie or whatever this is?
Not $200 million.
Well, whatever it was. I feel like it probably cost $200 million to shoot at Fenway Park.
Under 100.
Lee, this is the $40 million equivalent of the $250 million Avatar payroll that they had. And this is the little movie that could, obviously. This is a sabermetric movie. Anyway,
yeah, with the Island of Misfit Toys.
Exactly. Like Brad Pitt. Ugh, who wants that guy in their movie?
But the interesting thing about this movie is like how much it seemed like Bennett Miller knew what he was doing all the way through from start to finish. Because there's, if you watch this movie, it's not like beginning, middle, and end storytelling. You know, there's flashbacks. There's scenes when there's like, you know, sports radio show host talking and we're watching another action. And the way it's kind of all put together is messy, you know, in
a good way.
Exactly, in a good way. I say messy, you know, that has a negative connotation to it. But what I really mean is that it's, you know, just kind of jumbled all in there, but it's jumbled all in there in a perfect way, and it all flows very well. And to do that, for Bennett Miller to be able to do that, he had to know going in every time he shot something where that was going and what was going to be happening. And that says a lot about a director, I think.
Yeah, I love the way that he used found footage and found audio and how he integrated it into this movie. And he did it so seamlessly, yet he cut between, you know, clearly actors playing him to the actual footage, and you never questioned it. And the way that the shots he decided to choose just flowed really well. And yeah, you're right. I mean, it was just that he sort of had this grasp on what he wanted to do, which is ironic for when, like, we were shooting there, and we can sort of tell a little bit of the tidbits of that. Like, we're like, why is and this stuff was in the film for the most part. We're like, why is Brad Pitt coming into Fenway on an entrance where the House of Blues is there, and the House of Blues wasn't there back in 2002? Or there's, you can still see the outlines of the banners behind Brad Pitt's head for the wins that happened in the future, and we're like, oh, they're going to take that out in post. But I guess Bennett Miller had a bigger concentration than what we had, because we were sort of there in a small scope, and he wasn't worried about the little things as much as he was about the story in its entirety, and he did a really great job with it. And I think part of it is that he had a lot of great people around him. I mean, he had Wally Pfister as his DP, so, I mean, who people know from as Christopher Nolan's DP, for the most part, in, you know, the Dark Knight and Batman Begins movies. And if you're going to be choosing shots on the day, Wally Pfister's probably a good guy to have in your corner. And right. The other thing is the rewrite, or the... I don't know how much involvement he had, but Aaron Sorkin was part of the screenplay, part of writing the screenplay. And you could definitely feel that, just the way these characters interacted. No scene went on too long. There was no dialogue where it was kind of, like, weird. It was, you know, it had that Social Network sort of feel to it and preciseness to it. And all that coming together, it just really worked well for this film.
This is definitely a movie that I could have just kept watching. Like, yes. If they had the rest of the story to tell, I could have just kept watching it.
I could have watched it all the way till present time. I don't even know where Billy Bean is right now.
Man,
he's still GMing the A's.
He is.
Which is another story that, like, it's all, like, almost, to me, kind of an almost more interesting story. Like, because, you know, John Henry has a line in the film that says, "The first guy through the wall always gets bloody." Well, so that's true, and Billy Bean took the beating for what something now that he absolutely won't ever be rewarded for, because now other teams have succeeded with his model. So even if he does, it's not going to matter as much, which I think is kind of an interesting story. Like, he's kind of just fighting a battle he can never win.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in a way.
In a way, he's won, though, just by being recognized.
But not
for...
You know, if you're going to follow his standards in the movie, he hasn't, though. You know, his goal is to win a World Series, win the last game of the series. And even if that happens now, you know, using his model, it, like he said, it's not going to change baseball, because baseball's already been changed.
Yeah. And Yeah, or like, you know, we can he can be romanticized like in this movie, but yeah, if he doesn't win that last game of the year, then it doesn't mean anything. You know, same with his 20-win season. Or 20 wins in a row season.
The 20-win season.
Yeah, that's all it took for them to get in the postseason.
Let's talk quickly about some of these other relationships and the flashbacks in the film. Do you feel, because, you know, there were these relationships with, like, Sharon, who's played by Robin Wright as his ex-wife, or his daughter, or even some of the players that were smaller. Do you think they added a lot to the movie, or could they have expanded upon them? And also my other question is, did the flashbacks help define Billy Bean's character for you guys? Did they work?
The flashbacks at first seemed like it was kind of like, okay, I guess we're just seeing more about Billy Bean. But, I mean, they paid off incredibly when, you know, when he had that one line of dialogue saying he made one decision in his life based on money and he said he wouldn't do it again.
I think they paid off throughout, just understanding where he came from as far as his professional career. I think because a lot of what you see is about that, because he's sort of a victim of the scouting system as it was.
And yeah, that's true.
He didn't want to – he didn't think that worked because he, as a player, was highly touted and he never should have been, and he understood that. Because he asks at one point, he asked Peter Brandt, when would you have taken me? This is what he pretty much got Peter Brandt the job, and he's like, I would have taken you in the 9th round.
And, no signing bonus.
Yeah, no signing bonus. And then he's like, okay, because that's where he figured he deserved to be. And it's that understanding that really sort of drove where he went and the decisions he made going forward. And I think, I mean, flashbacks are always tough in movies, and if anything sort of took me out, it was the flashbacks. But I think they were done pretty well in this movie, and they were really there to give that information.
Yeah, I mean, I don't feel like it ever really took me out of the movie, but I definitely think having them there defined much of Billy Bean.
Mm-hmm.
And what you were saying about, you know, I don't think he was a victim of the scouting system, as you put it, but I do think it just showed some of the flaws within the scouting system, because obviously Billy Bean was a five tool player, you know, as these guys are called, the guys who are, you know, very well rounded and have all the different skills. But, and this is one thing that I thought the movie did really well, and why the flashbacks worked was because him, you know, showing those scenes and showing how he didn't make it really helped embrace, like, the mindset of baseball. You can be an unbelievable athlete and be incredibly talented, but if you don't have the right mindset, you know, you're not going to make it. If you start thinking too much about your swing or thinking while you're swinging, it's not going to work out for you. And that's one thing the book really established, was that, you know, Billy Bean, as great of an athlete as he was, when it came to, like, game time and, like, into actual pressure situations, he started thinking too much, and then he let his emotions take over, which is why he got so angry, and you see him, like, you know, trashing, like, when he gets back into the dugout. Because he's thinking too much, and because he's doing that, he can't succeed the way he used to, like back when he was in high school.
Right.
And that's why in baseball, obviously, is a very slow game. You have long periods of time to just sit and think about, like, your numbers and think about your stats. And that's why Billy Bean, like, one thing they don't cover in the movie, but that's in the book, is the draft that year. And his number one pick was Nick Swisher, and he won Nick Swisher mostly because of his attitude, because his attitude was kind of the opposite of his. Whereas, like, Billy Bean might get really frustrated because he struck out at an at-bat, Nick Swisher would be like, just let it completely roll off his back and be like, whatever, I'll get him next time. You know, because that's the mindset you have to have in baseball. You can't let any, like, the bad plays affect you.
Or and in sports in general, I think.
In sports in general, absolutely. Yeah. But especially baseball, which is just such a slow game where you have so much time to sit and stew about it. And so that's one thing that I think those flashbacks really helped establish, is just that mindset of baseball, and particularly in the, you know, Billy Bean's case.
A few points on that. I think that's an excellent observation. I think it was definitely intended purposely, which just bodes for the great structure of this screenplay, and which we shouldn't be surprised by, you know, Aaron Sorkin being involved. And it demonstrates it in a way that I've never seen demonstrated before. And as somebody who's played sports, not professionally, surprisingly. But that's absolutely the biggest part of sports is what's in your own head and overthinking. And I had also a tendency to be an overthinker in sports, and that's, you know, when I played the worst was absolutely when I was thinking too much about what I needed to do. And it's kind of people like that, just, you know, it's not easy. And Billy, and this showed it perfectly. And there was, and that would really lended to the character arc of Billy Beane.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, they even have, you know, what are termed sports psychologists now. You know, and I know, you know, obviously here in Boston, Jared Saltalamacchia had to go to a sports psychologist a while back because he was having trouble throwing back to the pitcher.
Right.
Which, I mean, it sounds like a joke. It's like, I think it was one of the issues in, like, Major League 2 or, like, 3 back to the minors. Something like, whatever the case was, the catcher, like, just couldn't throw it to the pitcher. Like, it was just such a mental thing. Right. But that was, like, an issue Salty had, you know, here in Boston.
He wasn't the first player to have this issue either.
No, not at all. You know, but it's just crazy how much, you know, how much your mind plays into sports. And, you know, and obviously he's not the first to have it. And there's other issues that guys go to sports psychologists for. We did want to draw on a pause right now, real quick, and give a big thank you to everybody who voted for us in the Boston's Most Valuable Blogger Awards in the dining and entertainment category. We won that category by the popular vote, and we were up against a lot of stiff competition. So I was actually a little bit surprised that we were able to take home the popular vote, you know.
Bring it home the hardware.
Brantley doesn't think our site's that good.
Not that I don't think we have a great site or anything. I just, I don't know. I guess I was expecting a lot of other blogs to just have more maybe readership, and therefore they'd get more votes and everything. And I thought maybe we'd win the editor's choice. But no, we took home the gold for the popular vote. So I think that's pretty awesome, pretty unexpected. And we just got to give a big thank you to everybody who stepped up and who voted for us. You know, we really appreciate everything that everybody did. And we wouldn't be able to do it without you, all our listeners. So thanks, everybody, for that. We greatly appreciate it. So one of the movies that we didn't get to review, guys, since we're all back here doing Moneyball, was Drive. And I don't know how it ranked for you guys, but I know for me, Drive was my most anticipated movie of the year. I loved the book by James Salis. I loved the fact that Nicholas Winding Refn was directing it. I was a little bit hesitant on Gosling as the star just because in the book, Driver is just such a badass. I mean, and I had my reservations about whether or not Gosling could pull that off. Now, personally, I think he actually did a pretty damn good job, but I'll throw that to you guys. Do you think Gosling took over that role and was able to own it like a BA that Driver is?
Yeah, I think he did a good job. It did bring up this point in my head, though, like when I was watching it, I was thinking, he's so interesting to watch, and he really is sort of a badass in this movie, but he would be so boring to hang out with, you know? He would have he didn't really have any personality, and he said maybe, you know, 4 things in the whole movie, which is what it was, but just the strong silent type. But in reality, he would just be so boring to hang out with.
Well, maybe, yeah. But, I mean that's the way he was in the book, too. And the book's full of words, and he still spoke probably just as many as he did in the book as he did in the movie.
I'm going to take that quote out, Brantley. The book's full of words.
Well, yeah, I mean, well, think about it. I mean, a book is full of words, and yet he only speaks about, I don't know, 50 or 60 of them in the book, I'm sure it's more than that. I'm exaggerating on how low the number is. But, But, I mean, you get the sense. Like, that was kind of the whole point of the book and I think the movies, that he is such...
I think he did a good job, but it definitely hit me, though, if this was, like, if we cut to real life and he was just there, I'd be like, so, what's going on? And he'd just sit there looking at me, and I'd get all nervous and flustered.
It's interesting that you bring that part up, because this script, this movie, had no unnecessary dialogue at all, which I often like, because I think that so often for exposition purposes, things are said that don't need to be said. And that doesn't happen in this movie. And I think, what needed to be said was said, and what was understood was left unsaid. And this did a good job of creating suspense and tension, and I thought it was really effective.
I think there was some moments of, not necessarily stale, but cliched dialogue within it. Especially with like the mob type talk and the money and stuff like that, I felt like was sort of forced and didn't feel. Well, we can talk about. See, this is going to be like another hour because we can really talk about like how certain points of this movie just didn't connect with other points of this movie. There was something off between its tone and its presentation of some things. And one of them was, to me, the dialogue sometimes.
Huh. No, I mean, I don't know. I never really had that issue with the movie. I think, for me personally, actually, I think this is a movie just like The Social Network last year, in which the director just had complete control of this movie from start to finish. I don't think, like Lee said, I don't think there's really any unnecessary dialogue in this movie. I don't think it's want for cutting dialogue at all.
What I really liked about this movie was it, like you were talking about, Brantley, the director had complete control over this film, which was both to its detriment and to its, I guess, excellence in a way. Where I started to be taken out of this film and where it didn't work was this movie sort of had a slow burn, which I loved, and I loved how it was building. And then there was this great scene, maybe one of the, it'll be on my top five scenes of the year, this great scene where they go and they rob a pawn shop. And I was just blown away by that. And I'm like, okay, this is where this movie's kicking off. I loved how that was done. I love how much control this director has over it. And then they got into a motel, and I guess, spoiler alert, then Christina Hendricks' head gets blown off in this way that just seemed out of this movie. Like, I was like, where did that come from? And then, for me, the violence beyond that was almost Kill Bill-ish, and it felt like it was in a different movie, and it totally, totally took me out of the film. And that, combined with the way that the story sort of unfolded in this sort of cliched a little bit mobster way moving up from that, is what really killed this film for me. It was like a tale of two halves for me on this movie.
So you're saying that the violence took you out of the movie?
The violence
was
the point,
was the detriment.
The violence was the point where it sort of hit me at how much this movie didn't, how it didn't fit into this film. It was like from a different movie. It was almost cartoonishly ridiculous. And that, on top of sort of the way the story unfolded moving forward from that, in this sort of cliched, I got to get out of town, I got all the mobster's money way, didn't work. This movie could have been like a new Leon or The Professional, where it could have been a nice, small, unbelievable classic crime film. But I think it took a turn for the worst right at that moment.
All right, yeah. So that's interesting, just because I think that, the introduction and progression of the violence was very intentional, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always interesting when you dislike something, it's not necessarily the director's fault because he did exactly what he intended to, but it just didn't register. anyway, for me, no surprise, because, I think this is definitely a big talking point about the movie, but the juxtaposition of tone and action in this movie I thought was brilliant. The 80s music, the flashy titles, set against like the dark action and the, everything that went on in this movie and the characters and the, unspoken things that went on, I thought was brilliant. I thought it was a huge risk to play it like that, because it could have just been, awkward or cheesy or any number of things, but I think it worked great.
Just to comment on that real quick. That was the part of the movie that, like, as a director being so in control, like, it shows you how it can go wrong and go right. Like, that was the part where it just went so right. It was just really cool to see a director take control and be able to do that. But on the same token, for me, the violence where he took control and was able to do what he wanted just took me out of the film.
There's actually two things. One is simply just that, you know, the idea that of who this driver was, basically that, you know, he is a stunt driver who moonlights as a getaway driver, that never was really explored. You know, we kind of spent a lot of time, like, watching him and kind of seeing how he reacts to certain situations, and, like, he's kind of adapting to something new, which is relationship with Carey Mulligan, and then he has to recover from the problems that happen because of that. But we never really get to explore him as the stunt driver that moonlights as the getaway driver, which I just thought was such an interesting character, and that's kind of what intrigued me about this story to begin with. But for me, the weakest part of this movie was that it was too long, and not in the sense that, like, a movie drags on too long, but rather if you kind of look at this movie like a bungee cord, you can make it longer, you can pull it and stretch it out, but there's not, you know, eventually there's not enough stuff to fill the space, like, and I think that's kind of what happened with this movie. It's about 2 hours long when really, like, you know, it was never, nothing, scenes didn't drag and scenes weren't too long, but it just seemed like there wasn't enough to fill in 2 hours.
And for me, honestly, I love this movie. I know you guys obviously had some problems with it. I had almost no issues with this movie. I felt like it nailed the tone and the feeling and the story of the book, and it was awesome. I thought Whining Refn knocked it out of the park. Your issue with the violence, Jeremy, I don't have that issue at all. I mean, I think in very many ways, especially if you've seen much of Nicholas Winding Refn's work, I think he very honestly is kind of the modern day Sam Peckinpah. He's a guy that always explores violence within his films, whether it's the Pusher trilogy, whether it's Bronson, whether it's Valhalla Rising or Drive. There's always actually what maybe we consider a lot of violence in his films. Some of his films are even a meditation on violence. Like, I would say Valhalla Rising is very much just a meditation on violence. Well, I mean, among other things, but obviously.
But you don't feel like he glorifies violence?
No, not at all. In fact, I think he shows, Jeremy, I think he shows a more realistic version of violence than most films do. What do you mean, here we go?
Because
he
totally glorified violence in this movie. The violence that was coming out of this film was only there stylistically to glorify it. It was so obvious.
No, actually, I don't think
he didn't need to kick a guy's head in until his foot went through his face.
And how much of that did they show?
They showed a decent
amount of
it.
How much of that did they show?
They showed it enough to see where his foot went through his face. That's all you need to see.
They showed that for a split sec.
It doesn't matter. They showed it. And, like, Christina Hendricks' head blowing out everywhere. Like, you didn't need that. She could have just got shot dead and it would have been just as impactful. I mean, it's one thing to like it, how he did the violence, that's fine. I mean, it's a director's choice. You can like it, I can dislike it. But to say he wasn't glorifying it is crazy.
No, Jeremy, if you shoot somebody in the side of the head with a shotgun, that's what's going to happen. Just like in Straw Dogs, if you get shot in the chest with a shotgun, your chest is going to explode.
All right, so if you shoot somebody in the head with a shotgun, it's going to look like a watermelon.
Yeah, actually, if you shoot someone in the side of the head with a shotgun,
Kool-Aid coming out.
Friendly's like, watch this.
They don't show any Kool-Aid coming out.
That's what it looks like.
It didn't. The violence in this film was definitely hard hitting, and
it was stylized and glorified. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that.
It definitely took people by surprise, but I don't think it was glorified in any way. Just like I don't think Sam Peckinpah glorified violence in his films.
Okay, when Brian
it's just like you see James Bond running around shooting people all the time, and there's just no blood from it. Is that a realistic? No, that's glorifying violence. By saying, oh, yeah, you can just shoot all these people and kill them, but don't worry, there's no real consequences because you don't see blood coming out of them.
Why
do you hate that argument? Because it's true?
No, because when you as a human being are watching a James Bond movie and they're shooting and there's no blood coming out, you don't have the same visceral reaction you have when somebody slices open an aorta and you hear it bubbling up like a volcano and just spilling out everywhere.
So the violence hits harder then when it's more realistic rather than when you can just shoot somebody and kill them and it doesn't seem like there's any consequences then.
No.
Because there's no blood.
It gives you more of a visceral sort of disgusting reaction to it that isn't necessarily necessary.
Be a visceral reaction to it? When you kill somebody, you're saying there's not going to be a visceral reaction. And when someone's actually dying in front of you and blood's coming out of them, there's
but
not
going to
be...
But he's doing it in a way to make it look cool. He's stylizing in a way... Yes, he is. He's deciding,
Agree
to disagree, gentlemen. Agree to disagree.
Some two-bit gangster bad guy who comes in and shoots Christina and Hendrix in the side of the head, he's glorifying that character.
He's not glorifying that character. He's glorifying that act that he stylizes it.
No.
All right. Well, we'll move on to the next thing. But you're crazy.
You're crazy.
Good podcast.
Jeremy's gonna edit that so it's all like Brantley's just like, I agree.
Probably.
Brantley, say I agree real quick.
No thanks. I love this film. Drive is my favorite film of the year so far, and I have very little bad to say about the film. I think overall, like on almost every level, this film was awesome.
So, this week, in honor of Moneyball, we decided to do our top five sports scenes. And I think, to spread it out a little bit, we weren't necessarily saying scenes from sports movies, but rather sports scenes in all movies. At least that's what I went ahead and did. So, Jeremy, I'll send it over to you first.
All right, criteria. It had to be a sports scene. It can't be like a regular scene between like two characters in a sports movie. The scene itself had to involve sports. It obviously didn't have to be from a sports movie, but the scene itself had to involve sports. And the other thing is no documentaries, or else I think Hoop Dreams would have been three of my five. So my number five, and I'm sure this is actually probably on somebody else's list, but I had to throw it on. It is the League of Their Own scene, the crying in baseball. There's no crying in baseball, Tom Hanks.
Yeah, that might come up again.
Yeah, I thought about it. I didn't include it in my list, but good pick. Lee, you want to go?
No, you go. I want you to go.
Oh, you want me to go? Okay.
Yeah.
In terms of criteria, I mean, obviously I knew they could be from, like, the sports scenes could be from any movie, although I was having somewhat of a difficult time thinking of, like, non-sports movies in which there were sports scenes. I think there's only, like, one on my list that I would not term a sports movie, but one has a sports scene in it. And so for that case, and these picks have no merit on how I think the film is as a whole. Because otherwise, why would Varsity Blues be my number five with the Thunderstruck montage going on? And just seeing a bunch of giant dudes fly through the air and, like, tackling the QB, like, totally, like, way over the top, like, tackles. Like, they jumped from 6 feet in the air and, like, are coming down on him in a diagonal. Like, you could tell he obviously jumped off a trampoline off the side of the camera, like, into the shot because they're, like, propelling themselves and they're so high in the air. And then the whole time you just have, like, Thunderstruck going in the back. Background.
Just like that.
It's exactly like that. In fact,
that got me pumped up. I'm ready to tackle him.
I know. So that's scene number five for me.
All right, my number five would be higher, I think, on most lists as far as scenes go. But I think I might be cheating just a little bit with my number five. But it's the scene from Swingers when they're gonna make Gretzky's head bleed for Superfan.
Oh, good pick. I love it.
Bitch.
Charlie steals the Munich.
Oh, money! Bitch.
So why is Gretzky on his ass again?
Gretzky's a little bitch.
God, this is such bullshit, man. This is bullshit.
The Kings suck in this game. We should play another team.
I took the Kings to the Cup.
Yeah, man. Against the computer with the offsides.
They're off. A finesse team.
They're
bro.
A fucking bitch team. Score!
Oh, bitch! You fucking bitch!
Watch out, no, motherfucker.
Do not fucking really? Hit my elbow.
It's not even so much me as it's Roenick. He's good.
Oh, is that right?
Galio steals the Roenick.
God, you bitch!
Score, Chicago!
Fuck,
oh,
man.
My God.
Oh!
Now Such fucking bullshit.
But that was pretty, Sue. Check this out on the instant replay.
Dude, do not.
You said it was fucking bullshit.
Dude,
check it out. Look at it.
The instant replay.
Look at it.
Yes.
It's a great shot.
If you weren't playing
the look at it. Look at it.
Come on.
Why do you think they put the instant replay in the fucking game? So you can see if it's bullshit.
Well, you know what? I am unbelievable.
Every goal, you're going to fucking watch the instant replay.
Look at it.
You got the game.
Come on, man. I want to fucking
learn it.
Never get to
play. You should practice this when I'm not here.
Just fucking move it.
When I'm not here, will you practice it?
Right.
We'll play some more. He likes to get scored on. Great time.
I knew that was going to be on one of your guys' lists.
I didn't even think about that. That's an awesome pick, even though that's, yeah. No,
it's only
great.
Partially, like, I mean, I guess some people consider playing video games a sport, and they're playing a sport video game, so you put all that together, and we'll go with it.
Yeah,
there you
I think that's a great pick. All right, my number four. I have a lot of the bigger ones, I guess, but my number four is the final scene in The Karate Kid, the crane scene. And I just remember as a kid just how impactful that was, just seeing him look ridiculous up on one leg and being like, oh, no, what is he doing? Everyone's going to make fun of him. And then, boom, he wins.
There's perhaps no better time for me to tell my Ralph Macchio story.
Yes, please do.
Who also, by the way, showed up at the rat party.
Why?
Really?
I don't know. I can't figure it out. So I'm on set one day, I'm outside, and I, like, look up, and I do a double take, and Ralph Macchio is, like, standing there by the sound cart watching the monitors. And, like, I'm like, oh, maybe he's in this scene, because we were shooting at, like, this Jersey Shore club, and I'm like, all right, he kind of has, like, that, you know, Italian thing going on. Maybe he's just, like, a funny cameo or something. So then he goes inside, and I'm like, all right. So, and he goes, like, starts introducing himself to the first AD, and then he goes over, and he shakes hands with the two people who aren't the stars of the movie, but they're not background actors. They're just, like, the two side characters in the scene. And then he leaves. He makes, like, this joke about bars to me, and then he walks away, and I don't see him again. And I'm like, and, you know, I think I determined that that's how he gets jobs or something. He just comes to set and...
Well, he's not very good at it because he hasn't got a job in a while.
But then he showed up at the rap party, and that kind of... I was like, maybe he just, like, knows... He must know somebody who...
Well, maybe he was in the film at one... Or were you on set all the time?
I mean, I was on set enough to know if he was in the movie.
Huh. That is weird. Yeah.
Interesting. But, my number... Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's all right. I was going to tell a bad joke. Now I don't have to.
Oh, okay. my number four, interestingly enough, is also the final fight scene from The Karate Kid, in which he does the crane and takes on evil Johnny Lawrence. Well, Johnny Lawrence isn't evil, but the Cobra Kai is. So
Johnny Lawrence isn't evil at the end because he says,
right,
yeah.
"You're all right, LaRusso. You're all right, LaRusso."
That's my favorite part of the movie. All right, my number four is from The Big Lebowski when they're talking about Jesus and. You know, says that can roll, and then he said nobody fucked with the Jesus.
That's another good. You're picking some good ones that are ones I didn't even think about.
Yep.
The rest of mine are pretty standard, I think. Unfortunately.
Yeah. Speaking of standard, my number three is maybe the best boxing scene. Well, I guess it could be argued, but I think the best, most violent realistic in a way boxing scene.
Glorified.
It is glorified, actually.
Yeah,
it is
no,
in a Raging Bull, LaMotta and Robinson fight.
Yeah, that one's obviously glorified because it's based on a real event, and he didn't bleed nearly as much in the real event. So right, that one you can say is glorified.
I said it's absolutely glorified.
I know, but I'm saying, like, if you want to make a point between what's glorified and what's not, like, this one's glorified because, A, no one bleeds like that in a boxing fight, and, two, he's bleeding way more than what
Why
happened
Why does one of these have to be glorified and one of them doesn't?
I'm talking about the scene from Drive and this one.
Yeah, I know. Why does one have to? Why aren't they both glorified?
Because the one in Drive isn't glorified.
Okay. All right, let me tell you that I'm sick of listening to this conversation, which means everybody else is going to be sick of listening to it.
I don't know. People like a good argument. We don't.
Yeah, but you guys are just saying the same thing over and over again. Yes, it was. No, it wasn't. Yes, it was. No, it wasn't.
Especially our guests. Our guests never argue.
No,
they're
too
nice. Too nice of people.
All right, Brantley.
All right. My number three, what I would say is like my scene that's not really from a sports movie, and it's from Cool Hand Luke, and it's the boxing scene in which kind of, you know, Paul Newman's the new meat on the, you know, on the chain gang and everything, and then the guy like challenges him to a boxing fight, and all the prisoners are all ratty for him. They're like, "Yeah, kick his ass, blah blah blah." And then like Paul Newman just takes such a beating that they all just turn away in disgust and are like, "Oh, I don't want to watch this." And that he never gives up. The guy, he's just like, "You'll have to kill me before the guy stops." And then he goes to try to take a terrible swing at the guy, and the guy just clocks him and knocks him out.
Yeah, I thought about that scene. I definitely have to see that movie again. It's been a long time. Got to revisit.
Revisit time.
No man can eat 50 eggs.
My number three has already been mentioned. It's the no crying in baseball scene from A League of Their Own.
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
Why don't you leave her alone, Jimmy?
Oh, you zip it, Doris. Rogers Hornsby was my manager, and he called me a talking pile of pig shit. And that was when my parents drove all the way down from Michigan to see me play the game. And did I cry?
No, no.
No! No! And you know why?
No.
Because there's no crying in baseball. There's no crying in baseball! No crying!
Underrated performance from Tom Hanks in that movie, I think.
I would say he's great in that film.
I would too. But I don't know if everybody would.
All right, my number two. My number two is from a comedy. It is from Naked Gun. It is when Lieutenant Drebin is the umpire, and he's getting into the crowd. You guys remember that scene? No?
No, I don't remember it.
Awkward. You don't remember that? He's the umpire, and he starts calling strikes, and the crowd likes it, so he keeps doing it no matter where the ball is thrown because he likes the... He likes the reaction of the crowd, and he starts, like, dancing around. And
that sounds like a good, funny scene.
Mm. You guys, both of you don't remember that?
I mean, I think I was six when I saw Naked Gun.
Come on.
And I probably didn't understand most of it.
I'm done.
It's been a while since I've seen any of the Naked Gun movies.
Ridiculous.
You're ridiculous.
Feedback at getyourfilmfix.com.
What are the feedback going to say? Like,
oh,
I saw
these guys are idiots. I can't believe they don't know about the Naked Gun scene.
I know about the Naked Gun. I just don't remember that specific scene.
What do you got for your number two, Bradley?
Number two is a scene that I think all of our listeners know, and that's from Miracle, and that's the Herb Brooks speech. So
you
deal
with
that.
You went with the speech. Interesting.
I went with the speech of all the scenes.
I was thinking about the end of the game.
I thought the speech.
Yeah.
That was on.
Yeah, you can go. You can go the end of the game if you want. Yeah, they beat Russia. Woohoo! That was like 30 years ago. I know
get
that. All right. I wasn't in the locker room for that speech, though. That's the part that really got me.
You weren't anywhere, anytime.
Anywhere, anytime.
You weren't even a concept yet.
Exactly.
All right. My number two, also already been mentioned. You didn't knock me down, Ray, in Raging Bull.
What do you think about the violence in that scene?
I don't know. I have no comment. I didn't think it was that violent. Was there violence in that scene?
Was there violence in that
scene? Just a little
movie?
Bit. There's a little bit. A little bit.
My number one is a movie I just saw relatively recently for the first time, and it is Pride of the Yankees, and the speech, of course, is or the part is Lou Gehrig's speech at the
That's
end.
That's a good pick. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, it was an honorable mention, but the fact that the Yankees are first in the division and the Sox
like,
are just losing so
Lou
much,
Gehrig.
I don't want to put anything Yankees on my list. So
I'm glad he died.
I wouldn't say that. That's rude. How insensitive to you and all of Lou Gehrig's family that's obviously listening to this podcast.
Obviously. But I like how Brantley won't include a great scene in a movie because it's about the Yankees. That's loyalty right there.
It's called Pride of the Yankees, for Christ's sakes. All right, whatever. Anyway, my number one, it's one that's been, I think the only one that's been on everybody's list, and that is from Raging Bull, and that is Jake LaMotta taking a beating from Sugar Ray Robinson.
And in the 13th round, the hard luck round, the championship of the world has changed hands. And there you see it, a champion gone down to defeat. And so now we wait for the announcement from Eddie Plick, the ring announcer. And then we'll get up in the ring, join with the radio audience throughout the world, and have a brief interview with Ray Robinson. Now we're waiting for the time to be announced. And it is being handed between the commissioner and Eddie Flick. The fight was stopped on a signal from Joe trying to hit the announcement.
Ladies and gentlemen, the winner by a technical knockout in 2 minutes and 4 seconds of the 13th round. And the new world middleweight boxing champion, Sugar Ray Robinson.
And the You Never Knocked Me Down, Ray, scene.
The glorification of violence.
The glorification of violence, which is okay when Martin Scorsese does it.
The poster apparently, scene
apparently in Jeremy's mind, it's okay when Scorsese does it, but if Reffin does it, it's not okay.
It's okay when it works with the movie.
He didn't say it wasn't okay. He just was arguing that it was glorifying it, and you were saying that it wasn't.
Anyway, I still think Dragon's
my number one is number the scene one. In Rocky. When Rocky gets knocked down in the 14th round and Mickey's telling him to stay down and you got the music going and then he gets up and then he starts beating on Apollo right before the bell rings. That scene is awesome.
I'm glad somebody put Rocky on this list.
Yeah. There's just so many scenes with Rocky. Well, I mean, there's just so many scenes with Rocky. Yeah. Like, which one do you go with? Which movie do you go with? And then it's just a matter of, like, it's going to be too cliche to put Rocky on here. Because there's, like, so many of them.
At the end of Rocky IV.
Yeah, exactly. That's the one right there. Not only does he defeat Ivan Drago, he defeats the Cold War right there, okay? He brings two nations together with that speech. Obviously the most impactful moment of all the Rocky films.
Well, really, of the 80s, if you think about it.
Of all the 80s, absolutely. Well, but, the Rocky films span from the 70s to the 2000s, so...
That's true.
I mean, that's a multi-decade arc of films, and obviously that moment just happens to be in the 80s from Rocky IV. Did you just sing 80s? Is that, like, all you just did right there?
Yeah.
What was that about? That's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast, even if Jeremy is completely wrong about the glorification of violence, but...
Edited out.
Who has final editing power? It's going to be like, even though Jeremy is completely right about that.
All right, well, anyway, that's going to wrap it up for us. We thank everybody for listening. We encourage everybody to go to the site, getyourfilmfix.com, check out the articles, other podcasts that are up there. I think actually the podcasts are kind of fun now because it's not just us three lamos all the time. You know, we're getting some, well, I mean, to listen to. I think it's funner to listen to when I'm not, like, in them, I feel like. Like, when we
about
get, like,
time
Peter,
for you.
Like,
yeah.
54 episodes, we finally got it right.
You know, and we got, like,
guys. Get other people.
We got Peter Mark, Michael, Chapin, Tyson, you know, those guys from Exterior joining. I think it's a little freshness to the whole podcast that we do on the site. So, I think it's kind of an exciting time for those. And, check out everything on the site, everybody. And thanks for listening.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.
I don't know. It's Catherine Zeta Jones' birthday today.
It's better to not ask questions. That means it's Michael Douglas' birthday, too.
He's 42.
And Michael Douglas is 70.
Jeremy just likes to read what he sees on IMDb.
I was close. Michael Douglas is 67.
There's a poster with Jackie Chan that says 9/11.
It's good to know you're paying attention.
All right, well,
Moneyball wins game one.
Oh, is it because it won the opening weekend? Clever.
It's a home run out of the ballpark.
Oh, look at that. And I'm sure, like, come a couple of weeks from now or come the Oscar race, they're going to say, it's in the hot for the hardware, or in the hunt for the hardware, or something like that, you know?
If
it tops the box office 2 weeks in a row, and should be like, Moneyball is streaking.
Yeah, exactly.
I should write headlines.
You should. Yeah, you seem to put just as much thought into it as everybody else.
<It's true. laughs>
All right, well.